I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object.
One through a party in the county jail.
Now let's rock!
Sugar's locked up, give birthday, let's rock! Everybody, let's rock! Yeah! Everybody, shout out! I'm gonna dance to the jailhouse rock!
We may have, well, he may have, embellished, lied a bit on our application. The woman we knew as Aunt Becky would get busted in connection with the biggest college bribery scandal ever prosecuted in real life. Lori Loughlin was in court Wednesday afternoon, hours after surrendering to the FBI. Authorities allege Loughlin and her husband, clothing designer Massimo Giannulli, paid $500,000 for fake athletic profiles for their daughters so they'd get recruited to the crew team at USC, even though neither girl had ever rowed.
That's right. Full House's beloved Aunt Becky is singing the Jailhouse Rock, this time for real. On the last edition of Parallax Views, we discussed the college admissions scandal in some depth with J.P. Satilli, the news vandal. And on this edition of the show, we'll be taking an even deeper dive, this time with journalist Albert Lanier, a dear friend quickly becoming regular guest here on Parallax Views. Now, the aforementioned Aunt Becky, otherwise known as actress Lori Loughlin, alongside Desperate Housewives star Felicity Huffman, are perhaps the most recognizable names in this sordid college admissions scandal. But it goes much deeper than that, folks. And Albert Lanier is here to break it down for us. We'll be discussing the scandal, the investigation that took it down, and the adjacent skullduggery of degree mills. All that and more on this episode of Parallax Views. And now on to my conversation with journalist Albert Lanier. Welcome back to Parallax Views, Albert Lanier.
Hi, JG. How are you?
I am doing good today. I've been extra busy just getting, news out there about, what's been going on with current events. We have a million different things happening, the Christchurch shooting, and now the college admissions scandal. You contacted me saying that you would like to come on the show to talk about this. How did you first come across the college admissions scandal? It's been sort of a... I want to call it College Gate. Everyone knows where they were when it first broke in the news.
I think that's a good way to frame it, College Gate. I don't mind that. Basically, I was online, and I think I was at my homepage, and I was looking. I normally check out the headlines there. I have to admit, I find out a lot about news and breaking news, especially online. And that's generally where I find out about it, and then I try to dig in a little more. But that's essentially where I found it. I think it may have been on my homepage, or I was online and I saw that this was a breaking story. And I have to say, I was a little surprised. Now, the reason why I'm talking about this admission scandal. Now, I have to confess, I'm not someone who normally, as a writer and journalist, has been into colleges and universities. I haven't really spent a lot of time writing about colleges and universities or college admissions. But I do have an interest in another area, and that is degree mills. And what in this day and age some people might call fake schools or fake degrees, what have you, and the whole fake diploma, fake degree aspect. And I came across that years ago. So I thought that was something that I've had a kind of personal interest in. And when this college admission scandal broke, I thought this would be a good time to discuss that aspect of fraud, meaning the degree mill aspect, along with this aspect of what is clearly fraud in college admissions. And also it looks into, I think, larger areas of American society. I haven't spoken about education or been interviewed about education in quite a while. So it's been a number of years, actually, since I've talked about education. And when I have talked about education, generally the public educational system, American education from basically K through 12, elementary to secondary, that kind of thing. But I saw this as an opportunity to look at something that has a kind of bigger impact in terms of people's lives. In many respects, and some people may argue, doesn't K through 12 or the basic education you get have more of an impact than, say, college or university? And I would argue that post-secondary education is more of an impact in this day and age.
Well, I mean, it used to be that you could get a high school diploma, you could get a decent job out of that, maybe working for something like General Motors. Times have changed, though, a lot.
Right. And I think that's a big reason why these parents, wealthy as they were in many respects, did what they did, basically try to buy their kids way into elite colleges and universities, because the college bachelor's degree, to some extent master's and PhD, but mostly bachelor's degree, has become the most important credential that you could have these days. In the 30 years since I've graduated from high school, I graduated from high school in the year 1988. So it's been over 30 years. I've seen how colleges and universities have become far more important in this economy and in this society than they were when I first got out of high school. And I think the last thing I would add is that education, whether we choose to admit it or not, impacts nearly everybody. You either have an education or you don't. And so the degree of education impacts everyone. And even if you do have a formal education, that is a post-secondary degree or post-secondary education and a credential, it will impact you as we can see looking at the news, looking online, looking all around us. We can see how it impacts people because we're looking at an economy that has changed. In a recent blog piece that I wrote called The Art of the Failed Deal, about the Amazon deal and how the rule of corporate America has expanded, I use the Amazon deal in New York, or that failed deal, as a setup to look at what's happened in regards to corporate America. And in regards to corporate America, since at least the 70s, you've had this campaign by the, let's just say, the corporate ruling classes to expand their influence and power through education, politics, and media. And this dates, in my piece, I date this from the Lewis Powell memo of 1971. When Lewis Powell, before he became a Supreme Court justice, wrote this memo to the U.S. Department of U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And I also include the I think it's the 1975 report on the crisis of democracy for the Trilateral Commission and some of their findings. Implicit in both of those reports, in both of those aspects, one, that memo, and the other, this report, is the idea of curtailing democracy by corporate influence. And so education is an area of influence, major influence, not only in the Lewis Powell memo, but I believe also in the Trilateral Commission crisis of democracy, because the educational systems were said to be failing in their mission to indoctrinate the young, or their job of the indoctrination of the young. So that's part of the reason I think this is so important. Now, that's sort of a grand kind of vista that I'm painting, a kind of very, you know, kind of almost like a Dutch school kind of painting that I'm kind of creating here about how education is important, or and also how it's been influenced. But I think that's how I want people to kind of approach it, especially in terms of other subjects that I've spoken on and talked about on this show and on other shows.
Well, I was going to say, you know, this college admission scandal, the reactions to it so far that I've seen from people have been very upsetting in a lot of ways. I'm glad there's people speaking out against it, but then you have the other side of it. You have people that are saying, you know, all these fans of Lori Loughlin, for instance. You know, I was talking to a soccer mom the other day, and she was going off about, I'm going to miss seeing her on the Hallmark Channel Christmas specials and, you know, Garage Sale Mysteries, I'm a fan of Full House. And I'm like, well, try to think of the kids and families that had their opportunity stolen from them because of not just Lori Loughlin, but others. And this whole scandal is not just about, you know, using donations. There was tons of bribery involving SAT scores, involving athletics, just fudging the numbers, fabricating students' histories. I mean, this is a real big thing, and people really suffered from it. The other thing that I've noticed are people saying, well, I knew that before everyone else did. I always had a feeling that was going to happen. And it's like this bragging one-upsmanship about, well, everyone knows the system works that way. And I just think to myself, but real people have been hurt by this. There were families mm-hmm. that got screwed out after their kids' education.
This is one of the major reasons that I'm discussing it on Parallax Views. And maybe on other programs, is because of my interest in the aspect of degree mills. And it's now looking at this admissions, I've begun to look into admissions a little bit, college admissions a little bit, which is an area I wasn't interested in. And I'm beginning to see just how really, truly dirty and rigged it is. I mean, I always considered it a rigged system. But this is not so much a rigged system that we're dealing here with, but with people who have a system rigged for them, who are trying to supplant and bypass the rigged system that is in their favor. That's one of the fascinating parts of the scandal. And they're trying to bypass and go through and around, really go around, a system that benefits them. I mean, this is affirmative action for rich European Americans. There's no doubt about that.
Well, it's like, as you said, the system is already in their favor, and even right. that is not enough, I think, is what you're saying. They want right. more.
Right. That's the thing that I think a number of commentators and a number of analysts have looked at. Here's the thing that I find especially just appalling is the use of athletics. Now, I'm not a fan of college athletics because I think it's a scandal-filled institution, especially when it comes to football and basketball. But the fact that these kids, that the kids of these parents were brought into these schools and the focus was trying to get these kids into these schools by trying to make them athletes, when in fact they weren't athletes at all. They didn't go anywhere near a soccer field or anywhere near an erg or a craft that was used in crew or track and field or lacrosse or any of these or any sport, high or low profile. That's the thing that I find appalling, not because I'm a fan of athletics, although I do like, you know, some sort of sport. I'll admit, I hate to admit this, but I don't hate to admit it, but I will admit it. I am a kind of a fan of USC football because I did used to live in LA a couple of times. But what I find appalling and should shock any college athlete especially is that a number of these kids were admitted as athletes when in fact they aren't athletes at all, and they didn't even go anywhere near any athletic facilities or fields or teams for that matter. That's one of the truly, truly appalling things. And it shows the manipulation and the outright fabrication involved in this entire scandal and this entire process.
Well, and the other thing is, too, you know, people that haven't really looked at the case, they're just seeing the headlines and not really getting into it. So many people are responding to this by saying, well, you know, rich people donate to schools and then their kids get in. I mean, that's just how it sort of works. This is not about simple donations. This is much bigger than that. And I don't think people should be able to get their kids in based on legacy and donations anyways, even if the schools are, quote unquote, for profit. But, you know.
Well, if they had done that, they would have been doing the normal, barely ethical, if you could call it ethical, and some people would call it unethical.
Legal but unethical is what I would say.
Yeah, but they would be doing something that's unethical but not illegal. It's not illegal to donate $1 million or $2 or $10 million to Yale or to Stanford so that they will look at your kid kindly when it comes to admissions time. It may be unfair. It may be what I would call an unfair advantage, but it's not illegal. These parents didn't even want to do that. I mean, you can't make any defense for these people. I mean, those people who are trying to defend them, and I don't know who is, but anyone who would try to defend these people has got to be smoking some herb that I'm not aware of, because there's no defense for this, even by the rigged and unfair standards of college admission for the wealthy and for the well-to-do.
Well, I was going to ask, just for my listeners, what is the human cost involved in scandals like this?
Well, the human cost, one of the things that I think it's important to look at are college admissions themselves. So what I want to do before I get into the details of what has been called Operation Varsity Blues by the DOJ, and by the way, could they not have come up with a better name for this operation than Varsity Blues?
I like that name, actually, I got to say.
You do like it. Why do you like the name? I'm curious.
I thought it was a little bit clever.
I guess Operation Animal House just wouldn't have worked. I don't know.
Oh, that would have been even better, actually.
That's what I thought. I would have called this Operation Animal House myself because of, you know. But I guess it didn't involve fraternities, so Varsity Blues, if I'm not mistaken, because I haven't seen that film in years, that's a film about high school football and about, I think the quarterback wants to go to Princeton, but his dad wants him to go to some other school. Again, I think it's an odd name. I don't want to get carried away by the name, but it's just an odd name for an operation like this. But in any event, before I go into the details, what I want to do is set up the context of admissions in terms of the system that favors the wealthy. Now, this man was recently interviewed, a man called Daniel Golden. Daniel Golden, I think, is now with ProPublica. But previously, Daniel Golden had been a editor-at-large at Bloomberg News, and I believe he was an editor at Condé Nast Portfolio, and I think with the Wall Street Journal as well. He wrote a book in 2006 called The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside Its Gates. I came across an essay of his in a book called SAT Wars, The Case for Test Optional College Admission. This book is edited by Joseph A. Suarez. Now, his essay in SAT Wars, the book SAT Wars, is entitled The Preferences of Privilege. So this essay, The Preferences of Privilege, lays out the different types of advantages in terms of admissions that wealthy students and their families can choose from, and which are often the case in well-to-do or elite universities and colleges. Probably one of the best known is that of legacy. You also have what is called development preference. Now, that has to do with parents who are not alumni. They didn't go to a school. Maybe they went to another school. We're not sure. But they're usually people of influence in the community or other communities, people like Hollywood actresses, like those that were involved in this college admission scandal, or celebrities, politicians, big captains of industry, you know, major millionaires, billionaires. You also have the athletic preference. And there's also the faculty preference. So those are just a few that this essay goes through. And let me just note what Golden mentions. About legacy, especially legacy, meaning that you have that you are the son or daughter of an alumni. Now, legacy admissions are probably one of the more controversial ones in regards to colleges, and they make up a good number of in some universities and colleges they make up significant amounts of admitted students. For example, one statistic that I came across is that at a number of top-tier institutions or colleges, it's somewhere between 10 to 25% of students that are legacy admissions, meaning, as I mentioned before, they had a parent that was an alumnus of the particular university or college that they are now attending. So you're talking about a rate. Often that's 10 to 25% at some of these top schools. They are often admitted on a basis that is 2 to 4 times higher than that of regular students, those who are not legacy. So people who don't have parents who are legacies, who are alumni and who are not legacies, have a lesser chance of getting into some of these top tier schools compared to legacy. Those who had had parents as alumni. Now, there's one example that's stated in this essay, for example, or an example. Brown University had, in the class of 2010, a legacy applicant rate of 33.5%. That was admission. So the overall acceptance rate for Brown was 13.8%. So this is double, that's triple that. So that gives you kind of an idea, at least in regards to legacy, which is alumni, and the advantages they enjoy. And it's also financial. Again, in the essay, The Preferences of Privilege by Daniel Golden, what he notes is that these legacy admissions often get tuition discounts. So it's not just that they get into the colleges and universities that they're admitted. They also get a deal basically on tuition. Now, the University of Arkansas is not a top-tier institution, I would argue, or I think most people would argue. But what Golden noted in his essay is that from 2008 to 2009, 185 children of alumni from out of state received scholarships amounting to about $9,000 a year. That basically would be the in-state rate. According to Golden, this translates to a loss of $1.7 million in university revenue that could have gone to non-legacy students. That is, students who don't have parents that were alumni. So again, look at, as we see in the examples that I brought out, you look at the legacy rate, 10 to 25% of students at these top tier colleges, according to one stat, that are admitted at least anywhere from 2 to 4 times more than a non-legacy. And then you also look statistically at that one college, which is not a top tier one, University of Arkansas, but they're giving 185 students out of state or out of state alumni, and in basically an in-state rate, because they're getting about $9,000 a year reduced for scholarships. So that gives you an idea of one advantage in regards to students. Now, most people would argue, or I think some of these colleges argue, legacies are important because it's a matter of bringing money into the school. And let's be honest, these colleges and universities are essentially businesses. No one wants to say that for some reason, but they are. The difference is that unlike for-profit institutions, they aren't businesses in a direct way. In other words, they are, you notice that traditional colleges and universities don't advertise anywhere near as much as these for-profit schools.
Yeah. I think our higher education system has really become neoliberalized, so to speak.
That's an excellent point. I think you have to look at the fact that it is that the neoliberal economic system impacts everything, including higher education. And this is why often at some of these colleges and universities, graduate faculty try to unionize, because often the teaching assistants don't get hardly anything in terms of resources at these schools.
Well, you know, I've known TAs who say that it's almost like the mafia in the sense that you're just waiting to get tenured, then you're a made man, they can't touch you. But if you're a TA, you know, you can get pushed around a lot.
Right. Well, it's what I call, prof slavery. You know, often workers and employees are often relegated or often seen in terms of analysis as wage slaves. So that's one aspect because of what happens with not just minimum wage jobs, but other lower paying and lower tier jobs. I call the grad assistants, not only grad students, TAs, but also adjunct faculty especially, basically prof slaves, because they get paid, especially the adjunct faculty, get paid very, very low rates, because they're getting, what is it, per credit hour rate in terms of their payment. They don't have offices. They're often teaching a number of classes. They're just people who have absolutely no benefits whatsoever. They work a great deal, but they get very little for the work that they put in. So I call it prof slavery. I'm sure there are college deans and presidents who don't like the sound of that word, but you know, I think that's essentially what's gone on with adjunct faculty and adjunct professors in a number of colleges and universities. So with the legacy, getting back to the legacy preference, what's important is that not only does this mean that these students of alumni, and they're often wealthy alumni, get a leg up, but that also means that someone loses out. Because if the rate is, like as I mentioned before, 3 to 4 times at some of these top tier universities and colleges, that means there are kids who have as good, if not better, SAT or ACT scores, as good, if not better, extracurriculars, as good, if not better, grades through 4 years of high school, and they're not getting admitted. So that's one of the issues with legacies. And wrapping up that part of it, I did want to note that the wealthy legacies are important. And I think for the colleges, universities, important because these are people that can essentially, as we said before, they can basically pay to play. They can donate a million or 2 million or 10 million or more to a college or university. And when it comes to admission time, the admissions officials can keep their kid in mind. And I don't want to say it's a rubber stamp, but it goes a long way towards that. I'll give you an example. And this is, again, from the essay, The Preference is a Privilege by Daniel Golden. The son of Bill Fisk, who was the U.S. senator, got into Princeton. Now, he wasn't the greatest student. He certainly didn't graduate in the top tier of his class. But his father and the family had given about $25 million to build a campus center at Princeton. And his father, Bill Frist, I think this guy's name is Harrison Frist. Harrison Frist's father was Gil Frist, who was a U.S. senator. And he's also a graduate of Princeton. So that's an example of sort of legacy, you know, what can happen in regards to legacy admissions. In fact, Harrison's brother was also admitted to Princeton. So getting to, and just kind of getting to some other areas here, one is the development area, and this will probably impact some of the people that were involved in this college admission scandal. But the development preference are people that are not obvious, not people that would have an obvious tie to the institution like legacy would or like alumni would, but would help also. They could also earmark some money as a donation to the school or help out with some well-chosen payments to the school. And so this is an example. And so this is another area. And this was part and parcel of where some of these families involved in this college admission scandal, which is ongoing right now, and will at some point be before go to trial. But this is where some of these individuals would probably fall into the development preference. And again, what this does is it takes a seat, it takes a slot away from a student who may not be upper middle class, or in this case, upper class like this person is. He may be lower middle class, he may be working class, he may have better test scores, better extracurriculars, better grades, better everything than this student who's the son or daughter of some Hollywood celebrity or politician or multimillionaire or billionaire. But those people are probably going to get the slot, and this person won't. The one that, as I mentioned before, was the most egregious to me was the athletic preference. And this was probably targeted by the parties involved in this scandal because they felt it was the easiest route to get into the school. And what a lot of people don't realize is that there are other kinds of sports. When people talk about college sports, they're thinking of football and basketball, maybe baseball. But there are also sports like crew, for example, basically rowing. You have equestrian sports, horseback riding. You have, you know, like water polo and lacrosse. Anybody who looked at the Duke case a number of years ago was probably aware of lacrosse. So you have a lot of other sports that aren't as high profile, but matter to a great extent on these campuses and within the orbit of top-tier universities and colleges. And so the athletic preference is an easier one because, and as we'll see by the details of the scandal, it's one that was targeted to maximum effectiveness by the individuals involved in the scandal, because it seemed like an easier route than alumni or legacy, and even for preferential preference, or sorry, development preference.
Well, it's so bizarre to me, because it's as if they don't think the system is rigged for them enough as it is. And that's what's mind-blowing about the whole thing.
Right. See, that's why I brought these aspects out, because I wanted to give the context of the system that people are dealing with in order to get their children admitted to the top or elite universities and colleges that are not only involved in this scandal, but in other, but just in general. The reason you have a system that generally reflects preferences for the wealthy, preferences in various areas. I just mentioned about three here. The legacy area or alumni area, the what is known as development preference, and the athletic preference itself. Now, one final thing I do want to know about the athletic is, and I found this interesting when I was doing the research here, is that it is not unusual for wealthy parents who get their kids in to schools and universities as athletes to have their children get in as athletes, but not really do a whole lot as athletes. The example that's given in this essay is Joe is the son of Steve Pagliuca, a former, I think he's an owner, one of the owners of the Boston Celtics. Now, Steve Pagliuca's son, Joe, was on the Duke University basketball team, which is a major, major basketball team in terms of the NCAA. That's probably one of the best teams in the country, and usually a power when it comes to such events like the Final Four and the NCAA championship. Now, Joe was a player from about 2003 to about 2007. So he was a player on this team, but he didn't score a single point during his entire 10 years of basketball game. Now, to be fair, Joe probably was able to get on the team, and he was able to stay on the team, but he just wasn't much of a player. At least he played, though. He may not have scored a whole lot of points or hardly any, but at least he could play. As we'll find out later looking at this scandal and admission, this admission scandal, you have people that were that weren't even athletes that were admitted into these schools as athletes. And so that's why I think, especially the athletic preference here and the way it was used is especially appalling. It's really especially appalling.
Well, another aspect of this, people are trying to divert attention away from exactly what this scandal says about our society. I've heard people say, well, what about affirmative action? What about these, mm-hmm. These people from black communities that are just allowed in on the color of their skin? What about that, though? And I think that's insane, but I want you to comment on that kind of backlash that people keep throwing out whenever a scandal like this happens.
Well, see, the problem with that as a way to divert from this admission scandal is that race is used as a factor in admissions. But when you look at this scandal, this is about an unfair advantage. Not about an unfair advantage used by parents, as I mentioned in these different preferences, but it's about circumventing an already rigged system. So you're already going going around a system that is generally rigged in the favor of wealthy individuals, in this case, largely white. Like I said, European American, as I call them, largely white and wealthy individuals. They have a system that benefits them. The system that we have in place now is as much affirmative action as anything else. That's true affirmative action, because a great number of these children of wealthy individuals, whether they be Hollywood celebrities, whether they be multimillionaires and billionaires from all facets of American corporate life, whether they be politicians, these are the true recipients of affirmative action. Because instead of race, it's wealth. Wealth is the criteria. So those that argue that somehow affirmative action is unfair because of race, I would argue that this is a form of affirmative action, and it's unfair because of wealth.
I was going to say, there's a word that's been thrown around recently. I believe it started with the Economist in an article called "An Hereditary Meritocracy, America's Elite." There are people now that are talking about this idea of hereditary meritocracy. I think often it's used kind of ironically, because I mean the term hereditary meritocracy, it's an oxymoron. What we're getting, though, is we're losing sight of the idea that, you know, people should be able to have mobility regardless of where they end up on the birth lottery. You know, what we are turning into is sort of an aristocracy in many ways.
Right. Well, the idea that meritocracy is somehow not just the norm, but if it isn't the norm, then that should be the norm. That is what you're aspiring to or what you're trying to get to. Overlooks the fact that meritocracy is by its very nature unfair, because merit is based on ability and skill. And if you don't have ability and skill, you therefore will not succeed in a merit-based system. So it is just as unfair to have a meritocracy as it is to have an aristocracy. And you could argue that a meritocracy is nothing more than an aristocracy of ability. It's those who have the brains, those who have the skill, and in this case, those who have the education. And what the parents of these children, what the wealthy, what the rich have always understood, is not just that the system is rigged for their benefit or generally rigged to benefit them, but that the system economically, the system politically, the system socially in this country is also rigged for their benefit. And that's why they're getting their kids into these schools.
I was going to say real quick, it's like this whole thing with Lori Loughlin and her daughter, Olivia Jade. You know, Olivia Jade seems to be doing pretty well with her, you know, makeup venture and being an online influencer. I think regardless of the college, she's going to make out better than most people in this country, regardless of college.
Right. Again, that ties to a point that I made, which is that the social, political, and economic system is rigged in favor of wealthy people, and the scions or the offspring, the spawn of such wealthy people. So when you look at someone like Olivia Jade, who stated on YouTube, I don't really care to go to school. Now, whether she meant it or not, I don't know. I have found out that she's a YouTube star, and she had deals with Sephora, which is a makeup line, I believe. But implicit in that is the idea that for her, college is not important. It clearly was important to her parents. I think she also reportedly said, and I haven't looked into this too much, that her dad, Massimo Giannulli, who is the clothing designer, had faked his way through college. And I didn't go through that too much, or I didn't really do research on that, even though I've been looking up all this stuff this weekend. But again, it testifies, and it's another piece, another brick in this wall of wealth, this wall of influence that the or this sort of wall in terms of our understanding of the scandal. You know, that's why I noted all of these different kinds of admissions preferences. And the reason I did that was so that people have an idea of what kind of system exists for these parents involved in this scandal, for them to take advantage of and for them to latch on to and use. And yet they decided to ignore this and to resort to extra legal and illegal means to try to get their kids into colleges.
And it wasn't just Lori Loughlin. I mean, there are dozens of parents and coaches and other people involved in this.
And this is the thing about this scandal that I feel is unfair. Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, who are the two well-known and most well-known subjects of this investigation by the Department of Justice, had their pictures splashed everywhere. You know, not just on YouTube, not just on every news site, online, probably newspapers, and they've been talked about. You have other names that are involved in this scandal. Names like Bill McGlashan, who is the founder of TPG, which is one of the largest equity firms in this country, perhaps the world, but one of the largest. He doesn't get talked about that much. But we hear everything about Felicity Huffman and Lori Loughlin. And I don't have a problem noting that these two ladies were involved in the scandal. But I have an issue with putting them front and center as if they are the biggest, like they are the most reprehensible figures in this entire scandal. Everyone involved is reprehensible.
Well, Lori Loughlin, I believe her husband is a real like power player, even more so than she is, but you don't hear him mentioned that often.
Well, he gets mentioned, but yeah, I would agree. I mean, you don't, you know, you see his picture a few places. But yeah, his wife is up there because she's the star of Full House showing on ABC and I think in the 80s. And she's become a fixture on, I think it's the Hallmark Channel.
She just got fired. They've broken off the relationship right with the Hallmark Channel entirely.
I believe she was filming a movie or she was filming something. I don't know if it was for Hallmark, but she was filming something at the time that she got arrested and brought back by investigators. I think she was in Canada, if I'm not mistaken.
You know, they used their house as leverage to basically get out of jail.
Oh, you mean for the bail?
Yes, yeah.
I hope they... I would assume they own more than one home. Otherwise, they're in trouble,
right,
financially. But the point that I made is I wanted to render the context by talking about all the advantages that the students of the wealthy and the students of, if you want to call it, the ruling class, the elite, have in regards to colleges these days, and to indicate that these individuals, many of them wealthy, many of them well-to-do, that could have done any of the things that I mentioned, opted to instead get involved in illegal methods and are now, it looks like, are now going to pay the price. We'll still have to see, but it looks like they're going to pay the price.
Well, I mean, I'm hoping that something comes out of this, that we get a sort of a bit of a sea change in how we view these things. I mean, you know, this isn't the only scandal that has happened in recent years with what I'm calling the new Gilded Age. I mean, we have people declaring Kylie Jenner a self-made billionaire. We have Ivanka Trump talking about how people don't want Medicare for all because they want to work for their medical expenses. I mean, it's just bizarre how privileged these people are, and the excuses and leaps of logic they'll make to justify what they do and how they live their lives.
Yeah, and let me just read something from the essay "The Preferences of Privilege" by Daniel Golden. And I recommend this if you can get your hands on the book SAT Wars: Case for Test Optional College Admission This is one of the essays in that book. He also wrote a book entitled The Price of Admission, How America's Ruling Class Buys Its Way into Elite Colleges and Who Gets Left Outside the Gate, a perfect summation of what is going on with this college admission scandal. That title says about everything in regards to this scandal, even though it's not about that. So let me just, as I mentioned before, when we look at the advantages that the wealthy and the rich have, they have legacy advantages they can take care of, alumni, if you have parents that are alumni. They have what is known as development for those who are non-alumni, Hollywood celebrities like Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman, politicians and captains of industry, you know, multimillionaires and billionaire businessmen. You have the athletic. You also have the athletic route that you can go in regards to potential ways to get admitted that will work in your favor. So you look at those three, especially the legacy, the development, and the athletic admissions preferences. And you can see that those are three preferences that the average, either working class or lower middle class, even middle class student, doesn't really have. The closest would be athletics. And that's why I say this should be appalling for any college athlete to consider when you look at the way that they manipulated this. And so when we look at those three advantages, especially the fact that, and there was also another one, which is faculty and administrators, but that's a little different because it's not something that these wealthy elites and would avail themselves of, because most of them wouldn't be alumni at schools. They'd be in the business world or in the political world or in entertainment. But when we add those preferences up, when we add the advantages, the development advantage, the athletic advantage, and the legacy advantage, we also have to look at they are part and parcel of a system that enshrines power and privilege to the wealthy and elite in regards to getting into colleges and universities. And this is just one aspect of this in a lifetime. It may be a truncated lifetime, but a lifetime for these students. Now, let me read what Golden has said in his essay. He mentions many colleges have developed special back channel routes to admissions for the rich. So that's one aspect. He also notes these preferences of privilege come on top of, and when I mean preferences, I mean the athletic, the development preference, and the faculty preference. The legacy preference. These preferences of privilege come on top of numerous other advantages for the wealthy in the educational process. These individuals generally go to excellent high schools that offer a much wider range of courses, foreign languages, sports, and clubs than inner-city schools do. Their parents introduce them to the world of books and travel. They can afford tutors, SAT prep, independent college counselors, and expensive extracurricular activities. Moreover, many colleges are not what is known as admissions jargon as need-blind. In other words, they have a limited pool of financial aid and consequently give preference to students who can pay their own way. So the rich should not even need legacy, development, and athletic preference. Those advantages are just cherry on the sundae. And yet, these parents in this college admission scandal didn't want the sundae, didn't want the cherry. They just wanted the entire sundae for themselves.
It's chilling in a way.
Yeah. And that's why I try to bring up the context of this and talk about these preferences. Because if we just talk about what goes on in regards to the admission scandal, people will think, well, it's rich people trying to get their kids in the schools. Yeah, so what? So what means you have to understand how the system is already rigged in their favor. And yet these people decided not to even avail themselves of a rigged system. I mean, to me, that's why this scandal not only is so massive, in terms of its size and its scope. But why it's so important? Because it sheds light on a system that already stands against working class and poor students. It already is against students of color and those of other backgrounds. And yet, these parents decided they wanted yet another unfair advantage for themselves. That's what's truly appalling about this.
Well, you know, I wanted to slightly change topics because I know you said an area of interest to you was these diploma mills, which don't get talked about enough. I was going to ask real quick, maybe this is a good segue into it. Are you familiar with John Gray? He famously wrote a sort of pop psych book called Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus, where mm-hmm. it's sort of like a precursor to this Jordan Peterson stuff, where he's like, you know, we need to go back to 1950s gender roles. But it's funny because it came out a few years back that his PhD title, you know, Dr. John Gray, he got his PhD from a diploma mill, you know, and yet everyone took this guy seriously. He was a pop culture phenomena for a couple years. So I did want to talk about the diploma mills because, you know, you see stuff like this more and more.
Yeah, you know, I have heard of John Gray. I think I remember hearing something about his PhD. So that sounds a little familiar to me. Now, one of the reasons I wanted to discuss this college administration scandal, because it deals with outright fraud. So let me just briefly deal with the details so that people get an understanding of this and then go directly into discussing degree mills. Now, when we look at this admission scandal, we're not talking about people who just wanted to use a rigged system in their favor. That wouldn't have been illegal. Maybe unethical, as you noted, but not illegal. The name of this operation was Operation Varsity Blues, as we noted, the DOJ operation, Department of Justice. Now, here's what's interesting. This began because an individual, I believe his name was Maurice Tobin, was under investigation by the FBI in regards to securities. I think he was involved in stock transactions that were kind of hinky, or stock transactions that were improper. And so this guy, I believe his name is Maurice Tobin, he was being sweated by investigators, and he stated, wait, I can give you something in exchange for lightening my sentence, or I can make a deal with you. You can lighten my load in regards to a potential prison sentence, and I can give you some another case, something that might be of interest to you. Now, what he told them was that a coach at Yale had told him that he could get his kid into the school for a bribe, for a fee. And so what happened was, I think, believe Tobin wore wire and talked to this coach, and the coach, I think, got arrested and started and worked with the federal government. He decided to work with investigators. He decided to work with the federal government. And that helped expose this area. Now, the federal government wasn't looking into this area. It wasn't aware of this scandal intentionally. They weren't aware of it. It was brought to their attention because of this individual that they were looking at in regards to securities fraud, I believe, securities issues. Now, this case, in regards to this admission scandal, involves 50 individuals who've been arrested, 13 college coaches, 33 parents. We mentioned a couple of them, Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman. I also noted Bill McGlashan, who was the head of PPG, one of the largest equity firms in the United States. Now, these parents had paid, according to the U.S. attorney, Andrew Relling, anywhere from $100,000 to $6.5 million to get their kids into top-tier schools, elite schools such as USC, Wake Forest, Georgetown, Yale, Stanford. As I mentioned, they paid anywhere from $100,000 to $6.5 million. The majority, or most of them, paid anywhere from $250,000 to $400,000, I think, per parent. This scam started, I believe, or it dates back to at least 2011. The guy behind this scheme is a guy called William Rick Singer, who's based out of Newport Beach. He ran a charitable organization called the Key Foundation, and he was a admissions counselor or admissions consultant, private one. And so what he did was he offered parents the opportunity to get their kids into these top-tier universities and colleges for a substantial amount of money. And so what he would do is he had, on one level, people take the SAT or ACT for students or change the answers after they took the test. In fact, there was a guy who was brought in, one of the test takers and one of the test changers, is a guy called Mark Rydell. This is a guy who was working for a private school in Florida called IMG Academy. And I think he's a Harvard graduate. This guy was said to be one of the best test takers in the entire operation. And he could basically, quote, nail a score. In other words, he was so good, he could almost say, what kind of score do you want on the SAT? I can get you maybe, I don't know, 1590 or a flat 1600. That was how good this guy was. And so that was one area, is that they either had someone take the test, the SAT or ACT, meaning Scholastic Aptitude Test, or the kid would go in, take the test, and some of them were actually allowed to get notes from doctors saying that they had psychological issues or issues with therapy or what have you, and allowed them to take the test for a longer period of time. So after a kid would take the test, one of these proctors that were paid by Singer and his operation would come in and change the answers so that they would get a bump up in terms of their SATs. So that was one area. Another area was trying to get kids in, admitted into these top-tier colleges, universities as athletic applicants. So these kids, many of whom were not athletes, didn't go anywhere near a field, didn't go anywhere near a track, didn't go anywhere near any sports facility, were involved in fake photo sessions. So they would have them pose, I don't know, and I think in the case of Lori Loughlin's kids, I think it was in an erg, I think it's called, for crew, rowing for crew, or with athletic gear, posing in with an athletic gear or on a field or what have you. In some cases, their faces were photoshopped and placed on that of actual athletes engaged in play. So water polo athletes or what have you. Then these kids would get accepted to schools like Yale. In one case, you had a student who was where the parents paid $2.1 million to get their daughter into Yale as a soccer player. The problem was, of course, she didn't play soccer. So they had to fake the photo, and they gave about $400,000 to the coach, the women's soccer team coach at Yale University. She ended up being accepted as a soccer player. She didn't go anywhere near soccer team or play, but she was accepted as a soccer player. So another aspect to this, and so when we look at this operation, what happened was that the money that the parents gave, you know, well, what happened was this Key Foundation, this charity, was set up so that what Singer had is he had the parents, I think, donate to the foundation, which would be tax deductible. And then, of course, the monies in this foundation would then go to these coaches and officials, doctors and so forth, as bribes for their facilitation of efforts to get these kids into these schools. I mean, it was quite an operation. So I just wanted to set up the nature of this operation. Now, why do I mention that in regards to degree mills? Why am I comparing this scandal or looking at this scandal in regards to degree mills? It's because they both require fraud, or both are dealing with fraud. Now, in regards to my involvement with degree mills, or in regards to my interest in this area, a few years ago, I was in the library, and I happened to come across a book called Degree Mills, The Billion-Dollar Industry That Diplomas. It's written by an ex-FBI agent called Alan Ezzo. He's retired. And a guy called John Baer, with a PhD. He used to work for the educational division of the publisher Pearson's. And he had written a number of books. So these two were involved in trying to crack down on and trying to fight degree mills. Now, you're probably wondering, what is a degree mill? What precisely is a degree mill? I'll just offer a very basic definition. I'll offer my basic definition. A degree mill is a company that A, pretends to be a college or university, and B, sells degrees that are not backed by any classwork or any exam basis. It could be some classwork or exam basis, but generally no classwork or exam basis. So they sell these degrees to individuals who will pay whatever amounts of money for them. And they will vary. Now, the degrees themselves are bachelor's and master's and PhDs in various categories. So I think you could get a degree in virtually everything. But basically, a degree mill is a company that sells degrees that are not real. That is, they're not tied. They're not authentic degrees that you would get through admission to a licensed and accredited university, and thus are not recognized as official degrees. I hope that's an effective description for people.
No, I think it is. Go on.
Okay. Now, let me just quote from another definition that was brought up by the federal government under the Higher Education Reauthorization Act of 2008. In the initial resolution, 773 in the year 2007, they noted that the term diploma mill means any entity that lacks valid accreditation by an agency recognized by a federal agency, a state government, or the Council for Higher Educational Accreditation as a valid accrediting agency or institutions of higher education, and offers degrees, diplomas, or certifications for a fee that may be used to represent to the general public that the individual possessing such a degree, diploma, or certification has completed a program of education or training beyond secondary education, but little or no education or coursework is required to obtain such a degree, diploma, or certification. Now, I know that's a mouthful, but I wanted to get this sort of congressional notation and definition on the record to give people an idea of how at least it was seen in terms of legislation. I think prior to the Higher Education Reauthorization Act of 2008, the idea of diploma mills and degree mills wasn't really recognized in terms of the federal government, in terms of the law of the federal government. So I think, and that's one of the odd things about these diploma mills and degree mills, these what I would call fake U's, as opposed to real universities and colleges, call them fake U's. This is kind of an issue or problem that is very extensive. In some of the research that I did prior to this interview, I took a look at a number of TV news segments besides reading up on degree mills. I took a look at a number of TV news segments, and this is an issue that spans, really, it's a nationwide issue. It spans the state. I saw news segments from California, from Missouri, from, I believe, South Carolina, and from Florida. This is also an issue overseas in Canada and also in the UK. In the UK, they've set up I think there's an agency that's backed by the government that looks into fake degrees and trying to crack down on fake universities and fake degrees.
I don't even know what to say. I mean, that's
Are you aware? I'm just curious. Have you heard about diploma mills and degree mills?
Yes. Yeah. As I said, I was aware of the John Gray stuff and just how it seems like you have people buying degrees, essentially.
Yeah. Essentially, that's it. What it does is it provides degrees of all sorts, like I said, bachelor's, master's, and PhDs, for a price to numerous individuals. And, you know, they can buy it. Now, the reasons why individuals buy degrees that they didn't earn by getting accepted into colleges and universities and finishing the coursework and graduating with the degree is for several reasons. One is the major reason seems to be job related. That is, the job may require a master's degree or even a bachelor's degree, and if they don't have it, for some people, the easiest way is to kind of bypass the system, much like the parents with college admissions in the scandal that we're seeing right now, bypass the system and go to some diploma mill or degree mill and buy a bachelor or master's or whatever, a PhD that they require, and basically go apply for a job. Often with people who buy these degrees for jobs, they can get a bump in salary if they have, say, a master's degree. You know, the higher the degree, the more money they'll get, especially if they work for state government entity or some kind of, state entity. You know, they can make more money if they have, like, a master's degree. And so that's a major reason. For some people, they want to be seen as educated, but they don't have the ability or the money or the opportunity to do so. And so they purchase these degrees.
So how do you, what are some of the problems that have come out of this diploma mill industry? What has been the cost of these degree mills?
Well, I can tell you how much money, in terms of some of the research that I did, some of the estimated profits that they make is $1 billion industry. And so you have places, not just in the United States, but outside. For example, there's Action, I believe I'm saying that correctly. There is a notorious diploma mill in Pakistan that's responsible for a number of the fake universities and colleges, and that has sold numerous degrees to people. In terms of the cost to society, you have thousands of people that could be in numerous jobs and professions that don't have the credentials that they say they do. So that's a big concern, because if you have people who have fake credentials and fake degrees, that means essentially they're fakes. But that could impact people. If you have a person that's teaching in the school system and they don't have the degree, they don't have a bachelor's degree, then that has an impact on the children in those schools. They may not be harmed immediately by it, But the lesson and the legacy of that is that you have someone who's unqualified teaching in the school system. You also have people who are in various professions. Now, doctors, lawyers, you've had engineers, you've had people who were even academics, you know, list goes on and on. So it's a big concern, because if you have people that are teaching in colleges, even if they're small colleges, not necessarily Yale or Harvard or so forth, or even a mid-range colleges or universities, like many state universities or community colleges. But if you have them teaching at maybe some of these smaller community colleges or junior colleges, what have you, and they don't have the credentials, you know, that's a blight on that institution. Again, it impacts society because you have people who don't have the credentials in jobs and positions doing these jobs that people with credentials should have. And that could very well impact people. If you have somebody who doesn't have a medical degree and they're working as doctors, they could kill someone.
Oh, but it sounds like a lot of scary things can come out of these degree mills. It sounds like it has a major cost and can make it can leave a major toll on our communities.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Oh, definitely, definitely, because you're dealing with people who don't have the proper credentials to do the job. There's a trust factor. Yeah.
Well, how did you first come across this degree mill issue? Because as I said, it seems like a lot of people don't really talk about it too much. It seems like something that should be spoken about much more.
You know, it's funny. I came across the book in the library. This book is called Degree Mills. I think there's another book that's out about diploma mills also. But I have to admit, I knew absolutely nothing about degree mills. I had vaguely heard of fake degrees, but I really knew nothing until I picked up the book, Degree Mills, and I started reading. And since then, I've looked online, I've done some research online and looked at news segments, especially investigations on local news, especially. That's very interesting. Various areas, like I said, Florida and Missouri and California and South Carolina, more recently. But it was really reading the book that got me interested, because it made me wonder I can't really get into the mind of maybe a person, because I'll just say I didn't know anything about this, because what I knew about education was what I had been taught about education, which is the traditional route of education, which is colleges and universities. Your, what I would call your normal colleges or universities, or your real U's. I mean, that's what I knew. I went to a liberal arts college called the University of Hawaii, West Oahu, and that's all I knew about colleges and universities were, you know, not only your elite schools like Yale and Harvard and so forth, but state schools like the one that I went to. So that's all I know about education. And to be perfectly honest with you, I didn't have any particular interest in higher education. The only interest I had was getting my degree. So that's what mattered to me. Beyond that, didn't care. Wasn't of interest. And when I came across this, it just made me curious. I was fascinated, because I thought, I assumed that the people who start these degree mills and diploma mills are, some of them are con artists, some of them are professionals in other areas, or not professionals, criminals, you know, sordid vermin and low life, I guess. But it got me curious as to why would somebody decide, okay, let me think of a scam or a scheme where I can make money. I know, I think I'll start a fake college. I mean, I just wondered what would compel someone outside of the financial aspect to do this. Because that's, to me, I go, what's in it for them beyond money? Or maybe it's just money. It, it, just that aspect just made me curious.
Do you think there's anything more to it than money?
I think for some of them, it's ego. It's like anything with being a con artist. It's like, oh, I can sell these fake diplomas and degrees to people, and I can get away with it. You know, I mean, this is a huge industry. Like I said, it's been speculated that this is about and estimated that this is a $1 billion industry.
This is not just some grifter scam that's low level. This is a massive, massive industry we're talking about here. I want to really nail home that point.
Yeah, that's right. Because you're talking about now, because of the internet, you can just put up all these websites for these fake universities, fake U's, and it's a lot easier now because of the internet compared to years ago. In reading about this and looking into this, what's interesting is that the idea of fake degrees has been around in many respects since even in Europe, this was an issue. That was one of the things that kind of surprised me, was that this goes back to Europe even.
And, really?
Yeah. In my reading about it. I'll give you an example. You know, for example, to get into, according to the book Degree Mills by Alan Ezel and John Baer, if you wanted to be able to use the research to be able to use the, like, the libraries at the University of Paris or the Sorbonne, you had to have degrees from Oxford or Cambridge or from some other university. So you had a trade selling these fake degrees or fake diplomas to people, even in the 1300s, the 14th century, which I find, again, fascinating. And again, in that period, of course, you understand that education was far more of a province of the elite than it is today, although we're dealing with elites in this college admission scandal, much more a province of the elite back then, because literacy was not as widespread.
Well, I was going to say, in a lot of ways, university has always, to some extent, been a tool of social reproduction, even going back to the Middle Ages. And I think in ways we're starting to move back to that in a very bad way.
Right. And I think so. Fundamentally, colleges and universities were set up to educate elites. This has been the case not only in Europe, but in the United States. So colleges and universities have always kind of pledged fealty to those who are wealthy, who are rich, and who have power and influence. Now, if you are somebody who comes from a modest background, the possibility that you would be able to get into the colleges and universities if you had the ability. If you look at someone like the playwright Christopher Marlowe, he came from a very, very modest background. He was a commoner background in England. But he managed to go to Cambridge and get bachelor's degrees and master's degrees. So there were avenues in regards to colleges and universities for the so-called commoner class, the non-elite. But colleges and universities, not only in Europe but also in this country, have largely been institutions for the well-to-do, for the privileged.
Well, I wanted to ask, with these degree mills, have there been any, you know, we're seeing what this call admission scandal, the federal investigations. Could you tell my listeners a little bit more about how the feds have been dealing with these degree mills, if they have?
They had a operation by the FBI many years ago called DipScan. And I believe that the genesis of this, according to the book, Degree Mills, came when you had some FBI agents watching Monday Night Football. And these were guys in South Carolina watching football. And there was a guy being interviewed, a running back, I think, for the Houston Oilers. called Charles Booby Clark. And he noted that he got a degree from this college called, or university called Southeastern. And these guys are like, well, what's this school? We don't know any Southeastern. And they were, I guess, stationed there in Carolina, so they hadn't heard of the school. So this kind of started the ball rolling into what became a undercover operation, or became an operation that dealt with this phony school called Southeastern University. And they went on not only to get the guy who was involved with that, a guy called Alfred Jarrett, but they also went after a number of other degree mills and diploma mills. And I believe that the entire the span of it was about 11 years for Dips Gang. They shut down at least about 40 degree mills. And again, they were making, at this time, I mean, we're talking probably the 80s into, when it ended. But during that time, they shut down these degree mills, and they, and these girls were making millions upon millions of dollars. Now, this is before the internet. So these were making just massive amounts of money, or a great deal of money. And you're talking about degree mills from this operation, degree mills in the 80s. So if they were making thousands, millions back then, what are they making now? What's interesting to me is the fact that there doesn't seem to be a lot of effort on the part of the federal government to go after these degree mills, diploma mills, despite the fact that people like Alan Ezell and John Baer have, you know, gone to different conferences and gone to different events and tried to kind of, you know, light a fire under investigators and other officials in the federal government to do this. The thing about the U.S. is, of course, is that education isn't really a federal concern purely. It's a state and local concern. So the states are responsible for kind of policing education. And some states will go after these diploma mills, and they'll have laws that, you know, tougher laws against them, and others will not. So it's basically on a state-by-state basis, which I think is one of the problems in regards to diploma mills. Sometimes that some states that get tough on them, these diploma mills will go pack up and go to another state that has lax, if any, laws about the schools. And I put schools in quotation marks. So that's been the usual tactic, is that when a state, someone finds out, or state goes after them, investigators go after them, they pack up shop and head to another state. If they haven't been, you know, if the proprietors haven't been arrested or eventually incarcerated, they wind up packing up and leaving, going to another state and setting up business and doing it all over again.
Well, I got to ask, because I have not really looked at it too deeply, but does any of this tie into, what has gone on with Trump University? A lot of people have described Trump U as sort of a scam. I don't know if it was a degree mill, but sort of a similar scam or fraud was going on there.
Yeah, it's funny. I was thinking about that recently. I haven't looked into Trump University as much. I don't know if they offered degrees. I think that was more of a real estate training sort of deal. So they may not have been a pure diploma mill, although I'm not sure. But surely there were some unethical aspects associated with Trump University. But I can't really say, I don't know whether it could be defined as a diploma mill or a degree mill. That I can't say.
Well, where do you think things are heading from here as we begin to wrap up in regards to these issues like corruption within the higher education system and also the issue of degree mills? And you know what? Maybe before we wrap up, you could just comment on this. There seems to be this meme that the right-wing noise machine has pushed out there about how colleges are these, you know, left-wing brainwashing centers. But everything we've just talked about seems to indicate that that is absolutely not true. That these colleges actually have just as much skin in the sort of capitalist game as really anyone else.
I think that's a very good assessment. I think for the right, it's easy to make these concoctions and trumpet them and promote them as fact when they are indeed fiction. I think it's easy to say that colleges and universities are these left-wing ideological indoctrination centers, when in fact they are essentially basically forms of business. The idea that schools like Heald or what used to be the Corinthian colleges and ITT and those for-profit schools are simply capitalist institutions and those are concerned with business is ridiculous. Yes, they are supposed for-profit, or some of them were. Heald and Corinthian colleges closed. I think ITT closed too. Yes, these institutions are seeking profit. They are directly saying, oh, we're in the business of making money. But so are traditional colleges and universities. The way they make money is different. The way they make money is by utilizing other aspects of their, let's just say, brand, utilizing other aspects of their institution. So if you're a professor in one of the sciences at an institution or college, you know, part of what your job, what colleges and universities are about are research. If you're a research university, depending on whether you're one or two or what have you, depending on what classification you are, when you're dealing with a research institution and research university, the whole point is to get grant money and to get money in for programs to the universities and colleges. It's a way of generating funds that will thus help with the quote unquote profits of the university. Of course, the universities charge tuition, and what they've done is raise that in a number of these schools over the years. That's making money. I mean, tuitions are a direct cost. So you have these professors, you have professors who are engaged in research and getting grant money and other kinds of money through programs. You also have tuition money, and you also have other revenue-producing aspects of universities and colleges, like athletic programs. If you don't believe that colleges and universities are about making money, then you don't know anything about football, basketball, baseball, or the major revenue producing and enhancing sports. So it's ridiculous to argue somehow that traditional colleges and universities are somehow the pure sanctums of institutions that are unconcerned about funding or unconcerned about making money. These schools are always about making money. The way they make money is just not as, it's not the same as the for-profit institutions. It's different. It's indirect. It's both direct and indirect, but it's mostly indirect.
Wow. Well, I was going to ask, wrapping up, do you think there's any, as I always say when you or any other guest is on, I always like to end on a positive note. I'm not sure that there is one in this case. It seems like times are getting darker, but I guess we have to keep on moving. Anything you can say about, you know, the future that may be hopeful in this regard?
Well, I know there are lawsuits that are already been filed in regards to this scandal. And one aspect has been, you already, when you look at admissions at colleges and universities, you had the Harvard lawsuit, I think, that dealt with Asian students and the feeling that Asian students were being shut out of major Ivy League universities because of quotas or affirmative action. I would argue, in regards to Asian students being shut out of universities or top-tier universities, that the real culprit is not African-American affirmative action or affirmative action for Latinos or other groups. It's another form of affirmative action that we just discussed, the preferences for the wealthy and for students who come from rich families, preferences in regards to athletics, preferences in regards to legacy, and preferences in regards to developmental preferences, celebrities, business people, politicians. The developmental, the athletic, and the legacy preferences are a greater form of affirmative action and a much more effective form of affirmative action for largely rich and white students than that for African-American and Latino students. Hands down.
Well, Albert, I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views to discuss the college admissions scandal and also this issue of degree mills. Like I said, it needs a lot more coverage in the media. Thank you again, Albert right. Lanier. Plug anything you want, and then we'll part ways on this episode.
Yeah, if people are interested in keeping up with me, they can check me out on Twitter. I'm at Critic Incorporated on Twitter. You can also see me on Facebook. And I write a blog on Medium.com. And you can check out that blog at www.medium.com. And look out for any other appearances on podcasts and radio shows that I may make. This is just one. But I wanted to talk about this issue because it's what I call fresh from the oven. It's really hot. So, and it, to me, it dovetails with this kind of fraud, dovetails with the other kind of fraud, because it shows you how corrupt our economic system and our society has become, especially in this one aspect, and the impact of education, how it includes the wealthy and excludes the poor and the working class.
The new Gilded Age, as I've been saying, right?
Yeah.
Well, hey, thanks again, Albert. It was great having you on. It's always very informative. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Albert Lanier. Be sure to check out his work. And also, if you can, get this episode out there. Like, comment, share, get the word out on social media. And if you are feeling generous, please consider donating to the Parallax Views Patreon. You, the listener, make this show possible. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.